Jen, where are you?
So I'm still in Big Fork, Montana at Flathead Lake. And because it was so gorgeous, we decided to stay an extra week. But they didn't have our original room available, so we had to switch rooms. And our new room, I don't know if you can see this over my head, it's the best art ever. It's two grizzly bears holding American flags in front of fireworks. And I'm obsessed with this painting, and I kind of want to buy it.
All right. Yeah, make sure that you take a picture of it. Is it painted or is that a print?
It's a print, I guess.
Either way, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Because it's like framed.
Wooden. It's framed and it's for sale.
Oh, really?
And I just don't know if I can justify bringing this thing in my little Honda down to Texas, but Joe and I are so in love with it.
You know what? I hate to be this guy, but yeah. Jen, if you get on Midjourney and put in bears holding American flags with fireworks in the background, it'll produce a comparable image that you can then have printed on demand and just sent to wherever you want.
But it doesn't have the story.
That's true. It doesn't have the story. That's true.
And she can say, I found it at Flathead upon Tyne, Montana, wherever you are. And I, you know, for somebody without a home, it is a shocking purchase for her home decor.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That's the problem. We don't have a home, but if we did, like, this is so perfect for some kind of man cave, which, you know, knowing me, it's also my lady cave because I watch sports and play games. And so Joe and I like definitely want to keep it, but we don't know where to put it except for perhaps the We're Not Wrong YouTube studio.
I mean, look, yeah, I will take it. In fact, I will, we can have a conversation off air about my, a subsidy, to have it up in the studio. So yes, we like, yes! Let's do it. Make it. So we'll figure it out.
Okay. I will talk to the people and see how much it is. Cause that's a factor as well. But yeah, we walked in here and we're on the top floor of this building and we have a gorgeous view of the mountains and the lake. And the first thing we see are the two bears holding the American flags. And we're so excited.
What? I mean, come on. How much can it be? What are they going to do? Execute rural justice on you if you steal it? Like, it's Montana. There's 50 miles between each human.
Wait, it is.
They're
going
to notice this fabulous painting being gone. Yeah, they have a sign in here.
Yeah, you can't. No, that's a wonderful. That is to steal that would be a sin against art. Like that's a great piece of art. But it's for sale though.
Yeah, it's for sale. They have a sign here saying that all the art on the wall is for sale.
Do we know how much it costs?
And this is like the center point of the building or of the room. So it's, you're going to notice if the bears are gone. They're too good. I don't know yet, but I'll go to the office and find out.
Okay.
What a so we'll big, see. Big cliffhanger, big cliffhanger for the listeners.
Yeah,
it is majestic the though. These bears are holding American flags and there's a big bear and a small bear and the bears are like photorealistic. They do not look cartoony. They look like nature painting, but they are anthropomorphically holding American flags.
Jen, I assume you've seen the wonderful, wonderful, painting series of Lincoln holding a gun and the Constitution riding a bear. And then next it's JFK in a astronaut suit on a horse in an astronaut suit on the moon. And then the next one is, have you not seen any of these?
No, I have no idea what you're talking
about.
Oh,
they're amazing. Like it's Reagan riding a velociraptor firing machine guns.
There's one of like Trump coming off an amphibious assault vehicle with an Uzi in his hand.
The most over the top, like 1980s action film stars, our presidents doing things. And it's always just like, how can we put in a little bit more Americana and firepower on this? Like that kind of thing.
It's very early aughts web junk, insane pastiche.
Mm-hmm. I love it. Yeah. You'll have to show me this when I get back.
You know, okay. If we have any, I really keep hoping we get some eccentric billionaires that start listening to our program.
Yeah, what's up with that?
Can I recommend a great idea for an art museum is the Museum of Kick-Ass American Art.
Mm.
Not good American art, kick-ass American art, which, by the way, I'm a lot more likely to go to. Like, if it was just like, yeah, this is the wing of presidents riding animals. Like, that would, I would drive, pick your state. I'll go to one of those, like, I'll go to a state I don't even like, just to see that art museum if you had
like
if you
what?
Had it.
Pick a state. Any. Well, actually, no, don't say it because there might be some weird Rothschild cousin that's from that state that want to attract as a billionaire patron.
I'm not going to mention it. Baltimore has a great museum called the American Museum of Visionary Artists, where normally art museums, you know, like this is the Cubist section and this is the Impressionist section. And then there's weird fucking descriptions where, like, have you noticed that at art museums, all the artists like so-and-so enraged at the position of the neo-cubists, blah, 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 blah. They're all like having these weird battles. At the American Museum of Visionary Artists, like they're like, this is the floor for artists with obsessive compulsive disorder. This is the floor for artists who are currently in prison. It's amazing. It's a great museum. And we ought to have more museums like that.
Yeah, I agree.
You should be a museum czar.
I like that.
You should be sucking up to one of the presidential candidates to get named museum czar.
I'd take the job. Yeah. I was about to say, like, there would be a part of me that would
go. He's the best. We're naming him Museum Czar. Museum Czar. We're going to have the best museums, thanks to you, mm-hmm. this strange, equestrian, fascinated beanpole, mm-hmm. Andrew Heaton.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It sounds like we'd have a lot of American crap in these museums.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you were the czar, and I'd be into it.
And another benefit. As I've previously mentioned on the program, one of my goals is to get DC statehood status by relocating every federal agency in DC to other states,
yeah.
which would create a ton of room for museums. And then DC would become the museum state. All those existing buildings
just
are now museums.
Sleepy, more museums than residents.
Yeah, it sounds great. I think that'd be wonderful for the state of Washington.
The other
two.
One.
The other one. The other Washington state.
There you go.
From Austin, Texas, I'm Justin Robert Young. And also from Austin, Texas,
I'm Andrew Heaton.
And from somewhere in Montana,
I'm Jen Briney.
And we're not wrong on this edition of the podcast. Boy, we're going stand up heavy. We're talking a lot about stage comedians, the firestorm over Russell Brand and what it says about the state of insider versus outsider media, as well as anonymous sources, and Hasan Minhaj in a New Yorker profile admitting that parts of his act were fabricated. Not necessarily the funny parts, but the parts that have him at the center of racial discrimination and crime. Jen, we're here. Where the hell are you?
I'm still in Flathead Lake.
What is the countdown for us all to be reunited?
Exactly a month from today. We move in on October 20th. So I just ordered my furniture. We're like all set. I'm excited.
That's going to be great because we're going to be in town for 2 weeks and then we're going to leave for 3 weeks.
Well, I'm leaving even before that because I've got a wedding at Edinburgh. So we're going to have reasonably little but joyous overlap.
It's going to be a big celebrate. Maybe we should we'll do a fan meetup. We'll do a fan meetup as soon as you get into town. Because I think the people of Austin demand it.
That's right. That evening, as you roll in, before you've unpacked, we demand you come to Cosmic Coffee.
Exactly. Okay. Just trailing packing peanuts.
Yeah.
Jen Briney makes her grand entrance.
Well, now that I've gotten Andrew obsessed with the bus, I'm excited to report that we're kind of on the same street. Like, it's just a one bus situation for you and I. So getting to...
Nice.
You know, it's harder because, like, Justin, you live off of easy bus sure. areas. But Andrew yeah. and I are in, like, great bus areas. So we're going to public transportation party while I'm there.
Things I only hear when Jen Briney's in town. You know, this is an easy bus trip.
Yeah.
Never, no one else in my life. I'm so excited that it's getting closer. Here's something less exciting. The internet lit a flame over the weekend when a collaborative investigation from the Sunday Times, the Times of London, and Channel 4 in the United Kingdom into Russell Brand was published. In it, several anonymous women point to a pattern of sexual deviancy, including rape, with a woman who went to a clinic and has medical documentation of the event, and a 16-year-old who says Brand sexually assaulted her during oral sex. Brand defended himself by saying that he denies the, quote, serious criminal allegations, unquote, made against him. He added that he has been very open to being a promiscuous lover throughout his career and that all of the relationships described in the pieces were consensual. He further described this as a coordinated mainstream media hit piece aimed at removing his power and reach, as well as other alternative media voices, including Joe Rogan. On Tuesday, YouTube suspended monetization of Brand's channel, where he has 6.6 million subscribers, and London's Metropolitan Police Service said it was investigating a report of an alleged sexual assault in 2003. It should be noted that that would be before anything covered in this piece, which began as early as 2006. I've got two things that I want to talk to you guys about on this. So we're going to start with this, Jen. How do we feel about Brand's use of the mainstream media versus alternative media narrative as a defense? It's something that a lot of people have brought up, saying that he's been preparing for this moment for years, moving more into a conspiratorial direction so he could have a narrative to deflect this kind of information coming to light.
Well, I mean, when he put out his video basically saying that the timing of this is suspicious because of the things I've been saying on my YouTube and Rumble channel. I mean, you're right that he has been preparing for this, hence why he has based most of his business on Rumble instead of YouTube. And then a couple days later, YouTube did the exact same thing that he said he was afraid of by demonetizing his channel. And I'm deeply disturbed by this because these are allegations. There's not like any kind of jury that's decided that he even did these things. And I really struggle to see how they are relevant to his work on YouTube. I mean, we've just seen this progression of these private public squares. I mean, that's the thing that's I've bitched about this before, where we don't have a public square. There are these private squares. And so Google gets to decide who gets to have a channel and who gets to make money off of it and who doesn't. And the fact that these haven't been proven, in fact, they're anonymous, it's enough to have him taken off of YouTube. It's exactly what he was saying was the purpose of this whole thing. So I just don't think that YouTube's move helps in any way to disprove what his concerns were. He has been making some really good points on his channel, and he has been adversarial to corporations in general, especially multinational ones. And so I don't think it's conspiratorial at all. I mean, I think you can be concerned about the allegations and be concerned about this being an effort at this time to silence him at the same time. And even about the allegations, I think the Onion said it right. You know, the nation could have sworn that Russell Brand was already a convicted sex offender. I mean, this is a guy who, especially during this time period, 2006 to 2013, his entire persona was being kind of a disgusting sex monster. He's talked about being a sex addict. He's talked about all of this stuff. He's made amends for a lot of these things, or at least he thought he did. He talks about how awful he was as a person and how he has taken a lot of steps to repair that. He's now married with three children. He's a different person now than he was back then. And I'm not saying that there shouldn't be accountability. You know, we just saw Danny Masterson get 30 years in prison for a rape that he committed back like 20 years ago. And I know that California got rid of the statute of limitations for rape in 2016. So that one that took place in Los Angeles, like, he could be prosecuted for that. But to have his YouTube channel demonetized before there's any kind of trial, I think it just kind of proves what he was saying, that his concerns were pretty valid, because to have your livelihood taken away because of an allegation, it just makes me wonder, like, where is this going? You know, as a content creator, I worry about it.
I would say a lot of things can be true at the same time without them necessarily being true for the same reasons. And I think that there are plenty of questions that you should have about the process and transparency of how and when a channel of that size that is moving the kind of money that it is moving, which is media company money. This is the kind of, this is the amount of cash that you'd be able to start a company and pay people and have livelihoods dependent on it. The ability to turn off that faucet immediately, I think, should probably be something that is transparent. I am unconvinced that this proves Russell Brand's theories for the reasons that he says these things happen, but we go to Heaton.
I'm bothered by the general concept of someone said you did a bad thing so we can ruin your life. I think that that's been endemic to cancel culture and this idea that if somebody claims anything, that we all just have to agree with it. You've kind of seen this national transition from believe all women to take all women seriously, which I think has been a very healthy transition. But when the Me Too movement started, as you recall, it was believe all women and there's a lack of presumptive of innocence. That being said, having read the litany of allegations against Russell Brand and the rather compelling evidence that backs him up, to me, this is different than just an anonymous person said he did something to me and everybody going, well, that's all I need. I'll put it this way. If I were a CEO of a company and Russell Brand were an employee, I would feel very comfortable based on all of the allegations there of removing him from the workforce out of respect and safety for the women working there. I'm big on proceduralism. However, I don't know how to circle these two squares where let's say that he does go to trial on this, and I don't know that that's actually happening. I don't know how British law works.
We know he is being investigated for something that was not covered in that that article. We have no idea the veracity of it. We know the details, at least anonymously, of what was published. We do know from what Jen said that there was at least one incident for which happened in Los Angeles, which does not have statute of limitations. And according to that article, there is medical evidence and text messages back and forth that seem to back up her claim.
Because he apologized.
Well, he responded to her saying, when I say no.
Yeah, she said, when a woman says no, all caps, that means no, goes on to say other things. He says, I'm so sorry, blah, blah, various other things. And then she, like, there's a record of her going to a rape treatment center that day. To me, that's very compelling evidence. And it would be very odd if somebody went, just in case this guy becomes a conspiracy theorist 16 years from now, I'm going to go ahead and fake a rape like that. Getting back to where I'm at on this, if I were the head of a company and somebody that was working for me had sexual abuse allegations from other members of the company, I would want there to be some form of due process, but I would not rely entirely on the government to do that. I would not say, six members of our staff claim that you've been inappropriate and sexually abused them, but we're going to wait until a court trial happens. Like I would have some form of due process internally, but I wouldn't necessarily wait for the government to do it. And if I were, again, everything I'm reading and the evidence that's been submitted in the Times piece I read, it's fairly compelling to me that this is not just he said, she said, that there is a clear pattern of abuse from a lot of different people. I think the relevant question would then be, should this negate him from using a platform? So if YouTube
making money
for making money.
Yeah.
I think that might be the relevant question to ask is like, Jen, let's say that it's confirmed. And he, tomorrow he admits, I did in fact rape a woman, but I really, really regret it. But I'd like to continue working on YouTube. Would you think that YouTube should continue to let him monetize his videos?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this is something for the courts. I mean, I don't see how this is work related. Like, it would be one thing if the rape allegation were someone in the company, if it was someone that was working for him, but these were the 16-year-old, that was first of all, the age of consent in the UK, which is where this happened, is 16 years old. So that wasn't statutory rape. Her parents were aware of it.
Which, can I just say editorially, Jesus.
I know. It's gross. I mean, it's not a decision that I approve of or that, you know, I would want someone that I'm close to. Like if you boys were dating a 16-year-old, I would have some words for you. But her parents were aware
in England.
It has nothing to do with the YouTube channel he has 15 years later. The Los Angeles woman, that was someone he was in a relationship with. One of the accusations did have to do with work at the BBC, but it wasn't a rape. It was, he was in an office and got mad at her for not, like, I don't know, sitting on his lap or something. But none of this has happened at YouTube. This isn't a workplace thing. So I'm uncomfortable with the idea that if you do something wrong, then you are shunned from all of society. You're not able to make a living anymore. You shouldn't be hired by any companies, that like you're guilty of this one thing forever and you get to be a non-person now. Like, I just, especially at the point of allegation, which is where we're at.
Can I just make one point about how YouTube works and how Google works that might bring a little bit of clarity to this? Google is an ad sales company. For whatever else that you do on Google, up to and including searching for things on the internet, that's not their product. Their product is selling advertisers access to you, and everything else that they do is generating your interest so they can put an ad on it. YouTube is no different. Pausing monetization is something, because the other part about YouTube is that they don't sell ads specifically on channels. Creators can make a deal with advertisers, and YouTube has fought them back and forth on that over the years. But as far as Google, Google sells against demos. And so if you are buying, like what I'm sure Russell Brand, I'm going to guess his demo is men 18 to 45, a very attractive demo for advertisers. What Google doesn't want, while this is in the news, is for a bunch of people, like, and there are organizations, nonprofits that do this, like Sleeping Giants, that will say, hey, Hefty, why are you putting money in Russell Brand's pocket by having this ad appear on his channel while he is a alleged rapist? Hefty will not have a choice as to what goes on there. YouTube has run into these problems in the past. So suspending monetization is something that, based on the technology that they make money on, YouTube I'm speaking of, I can understand. What I am troubled by is having no idea what the threshold is, having no idea who the board that makes that decision is, and having no idea whether or not this is a 15-day suspension, this is a 30-day suspension, whether or not YouTube would make things quote unquote right, or if for whatever reason things change. There's just no sense of process here. And as we saw with the Twitter files, sometimes the decisions that are being made are capricious and do not have a lot of oversight at all. It's two people on an email that make a decision and flip a switch. And that's where I think if we are going forward with these platforms, more transparency is something that I think platforms will be rewarded for going forward.
It makes sense to me too. But I think that's why we have chosen to do a direct listener support model. And one of the concerns I have is that we have overlords at Patreon who, I mean, I've met a lot of the people that work there. They're lovely. I'm not saying anything about Patreon, but just so much of our income, and I'm talking about all three of us, comes from Patreon.
Yes.
And just the fact that they could cut off our method of payment because of an allegation against one of us. I mean, this show, there's three of us. And so if there's an allegation against one of us, do they take down Just We're Not Wrong? Do they take down all three of our shows? Like, the fact that these companies are playing intermediary between us and our money, when I see something like this happen to Russell Brand, regardless of how I feel about the allegations, which I think are serious, and like I've always found him kind of gross personally, especially back then. I do think he's changed, but especially back then, he was disgusting. It was his thing. But it doesn't really matter how I feel about that. There are serious concerns about having these unaccountable corporations between us and our money. And this is an example of that danger.
Well, we don't have to go through Patreon. It's not that they're a obligatory interlocutor. It's that we utilize their network, and it's just, I would rather use Patreon than have everybody directly PayPal me or send me an envelope full of cash.
PayPal cut off the Canadian truckers.
I guess to put it another way, people are welcome to send me a direct check, mm-hmm. or to send me envelopes full of cash. But it is mutually advantageous for me and Patreon to be in a business relationship with one another, where they've created that easy on-ramp of software, and thus I can use them. But I feel like that's slightly off topic to the conversation we're having.
I think the fear is who makes the call.
Yes, and I'm in agreement with you both on that, and that I'm very much a believer that you can change rules, but they need to be equally applied. And so I am bothered when we get into situations where rules are, well, we like that guy, so we're not going to enforce the rule on him. Whereas that person's a shitbag. We don't like that guy, so we are going to enforce the rules on it. I don't like that kind of thing. Nor do I like it being just based on like, well, my gut says this. I want there to be clear objectives, and I want there to be an actual procedure that's being followed. And you raise good questions on this. And then, Jen, to your earlier point, I brought on Noam Dorman on the Political Orphanage about a year ago now, maybe 6 months ago, talking about cancellation. He's the owner of the Comedy Cellar, and he's the first guy to bring back Louis C.K. He was the first comedian, comedy club owner to let him back on stage at a big national club. And the point he had was very similar to yours, which I respect, which was that Noam should have the ability to go, I don't want to do business with X. So if Noam personally is like, I don't want Russell Brand coming to my club because I think he's a rapist and I don't want to do business with him, that's fine. That's your prerogative. His problem was when you go, by the way, you also can't do business with Russell Brand. I am saying that you are not allowed to have business with Russell Brand. And so his problem with cancel culture is not the idea that you must do business with everybody, but rather that you do not have a blanket boycott ability for everybody, that it's a one-on-one relationship or lack thereof rather than kind of a big block. And he made a good point too, in terms of like, to what extent do you, where does this stop? So for example, we find out that there's a monster that lives down the street. He's a Nazi. He's a rapist, things like that. Do we then pressure the electric company to cut off the electricity to his house? Do we pressure the water company to turn off the water to him? And at some point you go, look, there's got to be like, you're doing the economic and social equivalent of the death penalty when you do this. So I'll flip it back to you then. Jen, would you then just completely have media on an orthogonal track from all of this, like everybody gets unfettered media access, regardless of character or anything like that? You like, this should be treated as a public utility, like electricity. Google, YouTube should never kick anybody off unless maybe they're like, you know, actively inciting violence or something. Kind of where are you at?
Well, I mean, Justin had a really good point that this is a private company that makes money through advertising. So I think part of the problem here is the advertising funding model that has been chosen by the people that make their money off of YouTube. And I've said this before and I'll say it again. If we're going to have a digital public square, I think we should have at least one that's public, where yes, you get to say whatever you want. Nothing gets deleted. So you can go ahead and hang yourself in the public square, but everyone gets to see it. I feel like there should be one that isn't controlled by this black box of executives that are making decisions based on their own financial prospects, I guess is the word I'm looking for. Right now, we don't have a public square. So we've seen what's happened with Twitter. It's now turning into some weirdo's banking app. You know, YouTube can make these arbitrary decisions. Patreon's been kind to us, but they could get bought any day now and just decide that they're not going to do politics anymore and shut down all our accounts. Like, we really are. PayPal cut off the Canadian truckers. Like, when it comes to getting paid for speaking on the internet, right now we have no rights. So, you know, maybe we can do fine with all these public companies or private companies, but we need some kind of law to give us some kind of rights, to give us some kind of arbitration. Like, I just think that the public sphere has to get involved at some point to give content creators rights, because right now it is so arbitrary. We've built businesses here, and to just have them taken away because an executive makes a decision, I just don't think that that's, I don't think that's right. Like, we've built businesses here. We have nowhere else to go. You know, like, how can you put out content on the internet right now without them?
Well, I don't know if getting to where you want to be would be best served by creating a government funded or run platform that would do X, Y, or Z. But I do think that you could make a fairly mainstream argument to say that regulation for these companies could involve standardization of trust and safety and standardization of how a process works to remove a channel, to remove monetization, and have that be something that you would have to be in federal compliance for, and would bring a uniform level of expectation from users in the same way that you have an expectation for renting a building or something like that. Like that's federally regulated. So you can't just immediately kick somebody out.
I would be more inclined to that. I'm very suspicious of a government run public square type thing that would become the main lane for communication. Like I don't want to have government operated news. That strikes me as a very, very bad idea to have government operated news where some congressional committee either directly runs the news or appoints the people running the news, because I think that the powers that be would inevitably bend that to their message.
Or they'd hire Russell Brand like the BBC did.
Yes. and then just kind of taking that a step, one more step further, those exact same people that I would not trust to run the news saying, but you're in charge of this public square, though, the suspicions are still there. I don't think that merely by taking out of the private sector and putting it in the public sector that it would ameliorate these concerns. I think you'd have the same concerns. It's just instead of having a board of directors, you'd have bureaucrats, but they'd still have pressures, they'd still have incentives. And so for me,
that's why I said like part of this would be nothing gets taken down, which I don't know if anyone would want to create that, but in my world, like you put something up, it stays
right. Out. And you start, if I'm calling for inciting violence, if I'm coordinating violent KKK rallies, can we take that down? My guess is yes.
See, I say no. I say like, this is a great way to get yourself caught.
Somebody's going to be making the decisions.
Child pornography, not because there's laws that say you can't put that on the internet. And so the government would be violating its own laws if you didn't do it.
Okay. Well, the thing that I said is that we have no rights as content creators. So let's not get too far into the weeds. And like the fact that I think the public sphere needs to be a part of this.
What I was going to say was that because I have these concerns about, I do not think that a government run public sphere would in any way be a panacea for the problems we're describing. Okay. To me, the better model would be to have a proliferation of places we can go. Like I it seems to me that we're safest when we have lots of options rather than one option that's controlled by democracy. So if we had like 15 different platforms, that to me is a better scenario than having a public a platform that we're reliant on. I'd rather have lots and lots and lots of different options.
All right, let's talk about another element of this. And I'll preface this topic by saying that I found the article particularly compelling, knowing how these things are written and knowing where to read language that was written by a lawyer that was copied and pasted into an otherwise written by a journalist article. I can surmise that it was gone through a fine tooth comb in terms of protecting liability from a lawsuit. I don't know. I'm not as up to date on what those laws are in England compared to America, but I do know that there is the ability to sue for libel depending on various things. And I think it was very carefully worded. And I believe it is a part of a larger trend that I find to be unsettling, and that is shifting goalposts on the use of anonymous sources. And this is not anything specific with this article, although this article falls under that for me. I was brought up in journalism, and I was drilled into my head as I was going through journalism school and any professional job that I had that anonymous sources like abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. Like you should not use it a lot. It is a very powerful tool. And if anything, the prolificate use of anonymous sources defines tabloid journalism. It's blind items. It's stuff like Page Six. It's the New York Post. It's what defines a genre of journalism that is supposed to be a little dishy and catty and stuff like that. For institutions, mainstream institutions, to not lead a story like this with somebody on the record, and I understand what that means. I understand that it would mean that these women would face a lot of hate. I know somebody involved in this story that is getting a lot of hate on Twitter,
Russell
because
Brand.
Of their involvement. Don't even joke. That being said, it's not the role of the journalistic institutions to be nice with this stuff. It's a very powerful weapon to shape public opinion. And it's an ugly Old Testament thing to say you must put your name on a story like this. But I do think that those rules were there for a reason. and for stuff like this, which even as disturbing as they are, you could, in your most charitable reading of it, of which I don't share, but in a, the most charitable reading of it, it could be understood as consensual, that they were in a consent, non-consent, dominant, submissive relationship where things can cross a line, blah, 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 in the most charitable version of it. If those are the situations, I'm not saying that it shouldn't be written, and I'm not saying that his behavior should be tolerated or hidden. I do think that having somebody's name on it was something that was made very clear to me when I was coming up. And I do think that those rules were there for a reason.
I agree with that. I mean, Russell Brand is obviously a very public figure. And so the fact that he's been accused by four people who refuse to give their names, what that does is it makes it impossible for anyone else to either look for corroboration of their stories or maybe even witnesses that remember otherwise, because you just don't know who you're talking about here. So I just think in the interest of fairness, I do think both sides should have to say who they are at the very least. Like, I'm not a big fan of anonymity in general. And I understand that that would come along with, you know, internet hate, or, I mean, I understand that's a very scary thing, but if you're going to accuse a public figure a decade after the fact of doing something like this, especially if you're not planning to take them to court to do it anonymously, I don't think it's in the interest of justice.
Yeah, I agree.
Let me just say, I don't blame the sources at all.
It's a journalist.
I do not blame the sources. If I were, and I don't even blame the journalists. I blame the outlets. And because that's who makes the call on this. Every journalist will go with somebody with a scoop that they think is worth it and say, hey, they're only going to talk if they get anonymity. And then that goes up the chain to often the editor and publisher, and it's up to them to say yes or no. They get the final call on it. I don't blame a source for asking for it, and I don't blame a journalist for running it up the flagpole. I blame the ultimate person who decides on whether to do this. And it does seem that we have shifted our understanding on this, and I get why, because it's ugly to watch that torrent of hate come for people. But on the other side of it, having been on the internet long enough, these women are going to get it anyway. They're going to, the internet finds out, and whether it's these women or what the internet and Russell Brand's army 6.6 ambulant wanderers or whatever he called them on his YouTube video, they're going to find women to blame. Women they believe are the sources, whether or not they are. This is going to happen because that's just how the internet works, especially when you're trafficking in a story like this. I can understand the compassion element of it, and I'm sympathetic to the compassionate element of it, but maybe I'm just more of an Old Testament journalism guy think those rules were there for a reason.
You both bring up very good points in terms of due process, and we're operating in this odd world now where we still have due process within the court system. We've talked about this in terms of Hunter Biden and Trump and many of the other people that are there, where they're going through very clearly established procedures that have to be met. But so much of our lives now are dealing with consequences of the court of public opinion. Our livelihood is one. Jen and Noam Dorman, I think, make a very compelling argument that treating livelihoods as something that can have like a death penalty to them is like, I'm against the death penalty in the criminal justice system, having a kind of social death penalty where, like, well, you're just not allowed to have a house anymore. You have to be homeless till you kill yourself. I think that's a very compelling position to take. And when you're doing due process, if we're going to be culturally solving things, due process, part of it is that you get to face your accusers for all the reasons that Jen just brought up. If you're going, like, I would say that where the anonymous thing would make sense to me would be, hey, this guy is kind of a dickbag, and a lot of people think that he's a rapist. You should really watch out. So take that with a grain of salt, right? Where it's almost like a warning of like, how are you going to comport yourself personally with this individual? Or do you want to go to a comedy club with them, et cetera, et cetera. But if you're getting to the point where it is like full on livelihood, where you're not going to be able to work anymore, being in the article, they talk about how they wouldn't give him the names, but they would try, they claim to give him sufficient information to identify on his own who they were. And that's an odd take to take. If you are, we're going to give you these accusations. We're asking you to refute them, but we're also not going to tell you the names or the places. Yeah. That is a very difficult task.
Well, it's like at the core of this, it is clearly a he said, she said situation. And one of the key questions is, who is she? So how is the court of public opinion supposed to judge this if you don't know something that basic?
I think I found the article compelling. Like I said before, I have no reason to believe that the accusations that were made were not exactly how those women describe them. I found that to be compelling.
Yeah.
I have a conspiracy. You want to hear my conspiracy?
Of course.
Yes.
On why this happened. Russell Brand has not gotten a lot of mainstream work, and he has been very proud of that. That's part of his identity on his channel, that he is outside of the mainstream. He now only talks to his awakening wanderers. I just remembered it. That means that he does not make a lot of commissions for his agency. There is a part of that story where one of these women tried to come forward in the past, or came to Russell Brand in the past and was met by a lawyer saying that she was a gold digger and that this was absolutely false, blah, 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 blah. The people that protect stars are agencies, because agencies make their money on the star working. And Russell Brand worked a lot. He worked in TV. He worked in radio. He worked in movies. They very much tried to make him an A-list star throughout the aughts. That's a lot of money. He doesn't really do that anymore, which means that these are probably things that this agency knew about for a while. And the only thing that's different is now there's not a lawyer from that agency that's going to call and say, absolutely not, we will not cooperate with you on other projects that our clients might be involved with, either Channel 4 or the Times of London or the Sunday Times or anything else that they're affiliated with throughout corporate media. Throw big, angry lawyers at them so they can push them off certain positions and make the outlets question whether or not this is a story that is worth running. Now he's just a guy on YouTube, and agencies don't make money commission-wise on YouTube. My conspiracy is, indeed, it is Russell Brand being on YouTube that led to this being the case, but not because there is a grand conspiracy to silence the free thinkers or to protect mainstream media supremacy over independent media insurgency. This is about the fact that this stuff probably should have come out a couple years ago and before he had people defending him. And now the end of that story is his agency removing Russell Brand's picture from their website. And I don't think that those two are unrelated.
I think that's a pretty good theory.
Hey, Will, can you cue some ponderous after-school special music? You know, I learned something today. I learned that it makes sense for a company to quit doing business with one of its employees when they're a threat to the other employees. But when the company itself is a platform, and you're talking about removing someone's livelihood, you should think about that the same way you would think about the electric company or the water company removing their business from someone for odious opinions, whether you want to live in a society like that, and merely making it publicly controlled would not solve all the problems. You can cut the music now, Will. Thanks.
Oh, for fuck's sake, Andrew. I didn't say it would solve all the problems. I just think we need rights.
Well, I'm sure that this will be the last time we talk about public and private elements of our society.
Can I just retract my idea for a public square, because you guys are clearly offended by it, and I just want these contracts to be less one way?
I'm not. It's him. No, I not only want to see it created, I want to get appointed to the government to run it. I want to be the Minister of Trolls. I want to be the person just looking at the absolute, I mean, you talk about tragedy of the commons, a publicly run, you can't remove stuff, a message board would be 4chan. If it were run by Pinhead, it would be absolute hell. And I would love to be at the top of that pyramid of shit. So I am for its creation.
But here's a real question for you. Do you think if that existed where nothing could be taken down and you have to post in your real name, do you think it would be as much of a hellscape as these other companies are where you can post anonymously?
Yes, 100%.
You think people would say the horrible things they say knowing that it would be out there forever in their real name?
Yes, 100%. Are you aware that Facebook exists? That was the big thing with Facebook, was that, oh, if we make people say things in their real names. No, people will ruin their reputation, especially when they're adolescents, especially when they're boomers and they're lonely. People will ruin their reputations and say horrifying things. They get spun up on the internet because somebody said something that they disagreed with. Look how much we jumped down your throat because you said something that was slightly off kilter. Like, this is just what happens. People will say horrifying things. The one thing that I don't think people realize when you spin up a social media network is exactly the chore that moderation is. Even if you are trying to be wild and woolly and let people really have a free speech thing, the amount of child pornography, of gore, stuff that people post on the internet, oftentimes in their real names, and you refer that to the local law enforcement, this is massive. I once met a lady at a party in SF whose job it was, she was a contractor. YouTube hired her as a contractor to look at the things that were flagged and determine whether or not they should or should not be flagged. And sometimes it was a tween singing Katy Perry and she thought it was embarrassing. And so, or her friends were being mean and they flagged it. Oh, nice. Sometimes it was child pornography. Sometimes it was a guy getting shot in the head. And that was her job, was to watch that and determine whether or not it should really be pulled off. This is an actual problem. It is something that is very, very, very hard to deal with in a world where these platforms have safe harbor. And so you're allowed to post anything and you're not legally liable for it, which means you can actually get real-time posting. You would not be able to if people had to do that process before you post. But it's a very, very, it is horror at scale, content moderation. Doing it is, the stuff that gets through the cracks is a fraction of what gets held back because people are horrifying.
To swing on the other end though, Jen, in terms of wanting to have rights or even potentially regulation, I'm much more amenable to that. Like I do think that there should be best practices in place that I wish all companies would adopt. So like one of them that I think I've mentioned on the show before is whenever there's a media firestorm about like, you know, let's get the pitchforks out for this guy that we have a problem with. I think that there should be a 2-week moratorium before anything happens every time. Because I think the internet likes to get into a froth and like try to ruin somebody's life for sport. And there ought to be a 2-week cool down period where people actually go, okay, is this actually a thing that we want to pursue? Or was it just, we were bored? Like that's a best practice that ought to be on the books. Then like, you know, something you both were very, very good at, I think, articulating over the course of our conversation today was having clear objective standards that are applied rather than opaque or arbitrary ones. That's absolutely a good practice that ought to be there. And I'd feel more comfortable as a content maker if that were the case.
Patreon.com/we're not wrong. That's where you go to support this show. We're in the home stretch. We're in the end game. Guys, we are just a couple dozen patrons away from getting to 1,000 patrons, which are only going to be immediately taken away from us as soon as Jen's horrible past is revealed in a multimedia display. But until then, we make the real big bucks thanks to you. And we give you something for your money. We give you an extra bonus topic on this show. And this one's going to be light. We have two fairly serious topics. And then our Patreon episode, which tends to be a little bit lighter, is the United States losing an F-35 military aircraft and putting up signs like a lost kitten to find the $150 million a war machine that countries around the world would beg for and seek to purchase from us for more than what we pay for it. It's just sitting. Maybe it's in a lake. Maybe somebody stripped it for parts. We have no idea, but we're going to talk about it on the Patreon bonus episode. Hey, another stand-up comedian. Hasan Minhaj is a successful stand-up and a television host. His series, Patriot Act, ran on Netflix. He's currently the leading candidate to succeed Trevor Noah as the permanent host of The Daily Show. And according to a New Yorker article, he's also taken factual liberties with some of his personal stories on stage, including several relating to his experiences of racial abuse and profiling. For example, a story of a white Islamic convert joining his mosque only to be revealed as an overzealous federal agent seeking to entrap worshipers and eventually shoving Minhaj. Not real. Possibly exposing his daughter to anthrax. Did not happen. Nobody sent him anthrax to begin with, let alone did his daughter get exposed to it. Exploring a meeting to interview Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, the day that Jamal Khashoggi's murder was revealed, off by several months. Minhaj confesses to these disconnects, but defends the practice of putting, quote, emotional truths at the center of his story. Jen, you are a big stand-up fan, but I want to start with Heaton here because you are a practitioner of the art. What is the line between an exaggerated stage bit and an outright lie? And sub-question, does the serious subject matter change that calculus any?
Yes, I think so. And after deliberating on this quite a lot and talking about it with several of my comedian friends, we're in concert that do whatever you want as long as the result is a better punchline. We don't care. As long as the result is a better punchline. If the goal is humor, lie, we don't care. The issue with Hasan, however, is that he's not exaggerating jokes to comedic effect, which we all do. Every comedian I know, myself included, has a kernel of truth that we then take to an extreme position, or we massage it to highlight the contradictions more. That's fine.
There was a great now canceled Louis C.K. line where he was setting up a story and he says, I'm driving the other day. Actually, it wasn't the other day. It didn't happen. I'm lying. Anyway,
yeah, exactly.
And then tells the joke.
And that's fine. In the case of Hasan is not making these jokes in order to, or excuse me, he's not lying in order to further the jokes. He's not lying in order to reach a higher amount of laughter. He's doing it for one of two purposes, both of which I take issue with. One, he's doing it in a kind of entrepreneurial victimhood capacity, which is, I think, a somewhat new phenomenon in our society that I don't like. I started taking observation of this back with Jussie Smollett here 3-4 years ago.
A great French actor.
Where you can, you know, you can, if you're able to portray yourself as the victim, then you're able to sort of, or at least the goal was, to sort of use that as a springboard into better positions. I think that's most of his lies are doing that. His lies are in order to paint himself as a kind of hero victim that can further his career, not in order to further a joke. The other bit that I have a problem with is that in the I think it was the New Yorker that talked about this, and he was interviewed about it. His repeated refrain was, "Okay, that didn't happen, but I was telling an emotional truth." And I think that's bullshit. I think emotional truth is indistinguishable from confirmation bias. So, if I make up a story about how a bunch of MAGA Republicans were saying racist shit to me, and then it turns out that never happened, but I'm like, yeah, but they are deep down racist. So I fabricated the story to highlight that emotional truth. Well, I'm just lying to you in service for confirmation bias. And you could flip it around. You go back to like the 1960s and you get some white people that make up a story about how black people came in and like robbed their store. It turns out it didn't happen, but we all know that black people. I find that very dangerous. This idea of I'm going to further my worldview factlessly in order to promote the worldview that I have. And again, I would be fine if that were in pursuit of the punchline, but it's not. It's in pursuit of his career and in pursuit of a zeitgeist agenda. And so, from a comedy perspective, I believe he is ethically lapsed.
Jen.
So I agree with you. And I think what he has done, you know, I think there is a difference between him doing this on Patriot Act and on his Netflix specials. And I do think that's something that's worth a distinction, because on Patriot Act, he was essentially giving news and commenting on it. It was very Daily Show-like, which I think is why he's in the running for that hosting gig. And he did fact check that. And I think it makes a difference that he wasn't doing that on his show. It was instead on Netflix specials. But the problem with doing it even on the Netflix specials, like, it's one thing to do it if you're in a small comedy club, there's 10 people. Meh. But Netflix specials are seen by millions of people. And his position that he's putting himself forward as is a person who is a Muslim American. He's a minority. He has a unique experience in this country post 9/11. And so even in watching these Netflix specials, there are Americans who are judging Muslim relations big picture based on the stories that he's telling. And it's really problematic that they're not true. And it's also problematic that he used real people in these stories. So for instance, the one that stuck out with me is that he talked about, there was some kind of ceremony that he went to and Jared Kushner was there. And at the ceremony, there was this empty seat that was supposed to be there for someone that either got murdered, but it was basically like an honorary seat. And Jared Kushner just didn't care. And he sat in that seat. That never happened. And yet, had I heard that, I would have held that against Jared Kushner. Now, I only heard about it by reading this article, but that's a real person. And then there was someone that in high school, he basically made up a story about how she was super harsh, like did not tell him that they weren't going to the dance together until he showed up at the door. But that was very easy to trace back to this very real person who then took heat for it in real life. And she's like, that never happened. Like, I told him a month before we weren't going to the dance together. It was a lie. So if he's going to make up stories, at least make up the people involved. But to make them up about real people on such a large stage, I do think it's harmful, regardless of whether it's funny or not. Like, even if he was doing it in pursuit of a good punchline, for me, I don't like that it affected other people's lives. If you're going to do it, you have to make up the entire story, including the humans involved.
There, the story that I cited in the intro where he was being in, according to him, being entrapped by a federal agent who is trying to get people to confess that they were, you know, being radicalized or moving into some sort of terrorist thing. He ends that joke by talking about a real thing that happened on the news where a man, some kind of federal authority was actually doing that. And then him saying to his dad, oh, look, I believe his name was Brother Eric. Yeah.
You were wrong, Dad. He was a sleeper agent.
And like,
although he was a sleeper agent in a different city.
And so the actual agent is quoted in the article. He's like, I never went to Sacramento, where Hasan Minhaj is from, and said that this happened. That was just an out and out falsehood. Here's my question to you, Heaton, and I think I know the answer, but just to spell it out. You are okay as a comedian to lie for laughter. You said if the punchline is funny enough, then you can stretch the truth. You can make up stuff from whole cloth for laughter. What he struck me as doing was lying for clapter.
Yes, and that's why he should be roundly remonstrated. 100%. He's
because that's a whole different thing that has very much grew like weeds.
Yes.
After Trump was not
a fucking kudzu.
I had Jack Allison was a former writer for Jimmy Kimmel on my show a while ago. And we were talking about comedy after Trump, and he used to write monologue jokes for Jimmy Kimmel. And he's like, yeah, when I was working there, we would save our best joke for what you went to commercial with. That was the biggest thing. You'd want the biggest laugh. We'll be right back. Duracell will bring you blah, blah, blah. Right. In the time that we were interviewing, I was interviewing him. It has to be 2017, 2018, something like that. He's like, they save the one that the audience agrees with the most for the end. So the end is not a joke. It's and that's why Donald Trump needs to not put kids in cages. Gigantic standing ovation. Thank God you spoke truth to power. Duracell brings you like that. That was what it was. And this to me was an example of lying for clapter.
I'm even going to make a slightly more clarifying thing. I need the help of a listener to come up with a better portmanteau than this. Clapter obviously is clapping and laughter, right? I feel like there's a portmanteau that would be like laugh tear, like laugh sympathy, laugh sob, because he's making a sympathy play where instead of everybody going, yeah, you're right, everybody's going, oh, poor guy, let's give him another special, right? Either way, it's bullshit, and either way, I agree with you. Clapter is a scourge within the comedy community. Like when I moved to New York in 2012, this is in 2012, mind you, President Obama's in office, and like you'd go to open mics and some asshole would get up and go, you know, this may not be a popular thing to say, but I think George W. Bush is a fascist. And everybody would start clapping. And I'm like, you're in fucking Manhattan in 2012. Eat a dick and die. Like no one disagrees with you, you piece of shit. Tell a joke, asshole. I gotta say, I'm not even a very good comedian. If I were a very good comedian, I would be doing a lot more comedy. I am a peripheral comedian. And so as somebody on the edge of talent, I can tell you it is so much more difficult to craft a good joke. It requires so much more effort. It requires so much more talent than to look at the room and go, I believe this thing we already believe. That requires nothing. And there's a ton of hacks that just proliferated over the last several years where you could just go in, make an orange man joke, say something about Trump being bad.
Tiny hands, tiny dick, tiny big hand, fat, bad, and like, fascist, and like,
there are a bunch of comedians that I really like and respect where I'm like, look, I agree with you. Can you get back to your job, please? Which is telling jokes. And I think that is what's going on here. This is doing these things in self-service to his own career propulsion rather than telling the joke. And on that too, the note of like lying about the joke, Jen, I appreciate your position that if there's collateral damage with an individual who's called out by name, that's a different ethical concern that we need to worry about. But a lot of the time when people are lying and the goal is the punchline, a lot of the time it's self-evident. So like, I'm a huge Jack Handy fan. I've got a signed book on my wall. I tried to meet him when I was in Santa Fe. He sent me a nice email turning me down. I love Jack Handy. And like he has a line in one of his books that's, I've always been really afraid of clowns. And I was wondering about why was I so afraid of clowns? And I think it's because when I was a kid, a clown killed my dad. Like that's, I think, a funny joke. But also it's an absurdist joke. We know that a clown didn't kill Jack Handy's dad, right? And we, the audience, are in on it. And so we don't really have to be in sort of, or like Stephen Wright had a joke about like, I used to work at a fire hydrant factory. I couldn't park anywhere near it. Like, we all know he didn't work at a fire hydrant factory, right? So like those things where you're lying and the joke's the punchline, I'm fine.
Well, and I have a specific example of that. So Tom Segura and Christina Pazinski have been spreading a rumor for years that Garth Brooks murders people. And that's so obviously not true that the joke works. But Jared Kushner being disrespectful and sitting in a chair that's meant to be ceremonial because it's in the front row, like, I kind of believe that. So, it has to be super absurd for it to be about a specific person. And then it's not mean.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, look, Eddie Murphy didn't name the Italians that got so fired up by Rocky they wanted to fight black guys. Like, he didn't say, like, and that guy was Doug, like, and point him out in the front row and give his social security number. Dave Chappelle did not name the baby that was selling crack in the ghetto in his, you know, famous monologue at the end of Killing Them Softly, his first big stand-up special. These are things that when you're anonymizing them, they are one thing, but also those were all jokes that were funny, that had punchlines, that had characterizations, that heightened to a level of absurdity that told a larger truth, like for Eddie Murphy, about serious stuff, about racial, the state of race relations in the 80s, about for Dave Chappelle, it is an absurd story that tells a story about the state of the inner city in the late 90s and early 2000s. That's the point of social commentary comedy, in my opinion. Richard Pryor and so many others that have come before them to do it, George Carlin. But I do think, A, the craft is the comedy part, not necessarily the commentary. It is blending the two of them together that makes it something more special. And I do agree with you, Jen. I think the specific naming of people that isn't
like the girl that turned him down at prom, which when they interviewed her, she's like, I didn't turn him down because he was from India. I turned him down because the hot guy in our class asked me out first and I liked him. Like, oh, that's kind of a nasty thing to name her on national television then.
Well, and just the way that he portrayed the story, that he showed up and there was another guy putting the corsage on her wrist. And she's like, I told him a month before that we weren't going together because that would be a really harsh thing to do. But back to the anonymity thing, there is a comedian. So Kathy Griffin kind of made her entire stand-up career off of not anonymizing the people that she talked about. But I think that there's a difference in what she did and what Hassan did, because her stories were, a lot of them, kind of mundane, and she found the comedy in her own reactions to these, you know, I walked by Martha Stewart type situations. So they were true situations that she found the comedy in. I think where he crossed the line was these were untrue stories that made the other people look bad. And then he kind of like made a joke around something that wasn't even real. So I feel like
they look bad and made him the hero victim,
a plucky underdog on the right side of history in a world for which, no matter how liberal it says it is indeed ever as racist as it ever was. That is something for which, obviously, that is mainstream thought, and it is mainstream thought for viewers of the Patriot Act. It is mainstream thought for viewers of his specials. It's mainstream thought for a lot of America that is the case. So I don't blame him for taking advantage of it. And we can have a larger conversation on whether or not that is gross or not. But there is a reality that he didn't do this because he was wildcatting for oil. He did it because he knew it was going to get a reaction.
Can I get input from both of you on something that I'm a little bit worried about on my end? Like you brought up Louis C.K. earlier, Justin, and I think he's a good example of what I would say is lying in service of the joke. I know he did an interview where on one of his albums, he's making fun of how sardonic and ironic people have become. And there's two guys, he's sitting in a coffee shop and there's two guys. And one of them goes, I saw Tina yesterday. And the other guy goes, that's hilarious. And he has a whole bit about how everybody's so sardonic. Turns out he fabricated that all whole cloth. And my immediate instinct is to go, right, but he's making a joke, kind of a broad social observation, as opposed to like an us versus them confirmation bias. But when you bring up like Eddie Murphy or Dave Chappelle, there's still some us versus them elements there. So am I just picking favorites? Am I just going, well, I like Louis C.K. and I don't like Hassan as much. Therefore, I'm like, because I want to be consistent in my ethics here. And I'm a little bit worried that I'm just carving out exemptions for people and then doing some hand waving.
Well, I think what makes this different, like in your example of what Louis does, is he's pointing to something that I think we've all kind of noticed. It's almost like a universal observation, which is why we find it funny, right? Because I think every one of us knows someone who's just like, like we know what that is. Where Hassan is different is that he's speaking as a minority, as a Muslim, and he's in a way educating the American people. And so when he tells us he's personally experienced these horrific, you know, heartbreaking things, you know, like the racism that goes towards showing up at a girl's door and she's accepted someone else as the date and never told you, like that's so awful. And if he's in any way attributing that to the fact that he's a Muslim, in a way, finding that out, that it's a lie, it makes people question whether any of the racism is true, because we're learning from his experience. We're being like, oh my God, I can't believe that happened to you. I'm so sorry. Like, I'm going to learn from this. And then you find out that he's lying about it and you're like, oh, that doesn't happen. Like that guy was lying about it. So I think it's more damaging in that way, where if Louis C.K. is found to be lying about like some girl he heard in a coffee shop, like, you know, being dismissive of something, it's different.
Well, you used a phrase that I think is very spot on. You said a universal truth, and I think you're right. He's saying something that everybody can go, oh, we do look at our phones too much or whatever, right? As opposed to saying like this group of people versus this group of people. Like he's doing, in effect, observational comedy on a societal level, as opposed to doing
investigative journalism on a comedy level, which is what Hasan is effectively doing.
Well, there's also the element of kind of, and this gets into some nerdy elements of comedy, but there are some comedians that are more monologuist, that are more grounded in reality. And then there are some comics that are more absurdist and are telling blended and heightened fiction to tell a larger story. Like, the inner city is so fucked up, a baby is up at 2 o'clock in the morning selling crack. That's a larger, it is a heightened thing to tell a story about. Hey, it's scary to drive into the inner city. And even black comedian Dave Chappelle was scared, so scared that in this heart of darkness story, he finds something that even he is shocked by. The naming of the names, I think, is part of it that crosses the line. And to go to Louis C.K., to me, if you're going to say, all right, beyond the things that he got canceled for, just focusing only on his material, you know, he got famous telling nasty jokes about his kids, treating his kids like adults and calling them selfish assholes and stuff like that. That's something where Louis C.K.'s kids, as it turns out, that turned out to be among the least things that they had to worry about as they had to grow up with their dad. But theoretically, you could say, okay, well, you know, he's making jokes about his wife, he's making jokes about his kids that are personal and are mean and are directed. That to me is more along the lines of what happened with Hasan Minhaj. It's one thing to say, oh, I was at the center of this race-based crime, this race-based thing. If it's a general story, it's one thing. When you're naming the people and you're pointing out real, like people that you can track down, and now that's just hung on them, is you were a racist, you tried to racially profile Hasan Minhaj, you turned him down to go to prom because you wanted a white boy instead of him, like, that's ugly. That's really just kind of a gross, even in the context of art. You know, like, and we all podcasts have this all the time. We tell stories from our lives and we have to make a decision.
Oklahoma. It just seemed like a good backdrop.
Well, it's like, if I'm going to tell a story about if I'm going to tell a story about an ex-girlfriend, I got to decide whether or not I'm going to name her. I'm going to decide whether or not, for the sake of this story, I'm going to say somebody's name. I'm going to tell an old embarrassing story about, and I've told 1,000 old embarrassing stories on Great Night and the various different incarnations of it. And I have to decide, am I going to use the names of the other people that were there? I've often decided not to. In the moments that I've decided to do it, I have to understand that I'm going to get the reaction from that. And I am owed the reaction from telling a story that I have not gotten permission from somebody to tell, because it is partly my story as well. So that to me is the code. The code is, if you're using personal details of somebody, you have to be, especially if it's without their permission, you have to be ready for whatever consequence there is, because you took the risk to say it. And now they have the power to be mad, to be delighted, whatever. But unless you get permission from them, that's, you're just morally on the hook for it, wherever they want to take it.
Good points all.
So there's the anonymity part, but then there's also the claiming to be a victim to an extent that wasn't true in order to make people feel things. Like, what about that aspect of it?
I mean, that I actually have less of a problem with, because I've laughed at a million different jokes from Richard Pryor and Dave Chappelle and other black comedians that have talked about racial profiling and stuff like that, that would have been hilarious. And it's just the person has been the cop. It's like the cop says, get out of here. And I won't use other words that usually accompany these kinds of stories. But those are hilarious. I've laughed at a million of those.
Sounds like there was a comedic payoff to that. And like, one of the things sorry, we're recording this at my home. If you can hear my dog whining, he just occasionally goes, you've been talking too long. Also, he loves Hasan Minhaj. He's his favorite comedian.
Oh, one
of the truisms in comedy is, look, you can get away with a lot more if you're funny. Like if you take the same offensive thing and you put it in a funnier joke, people will be more forgiving. And that's just like a physics law of comedy. If it's really funny, you can probably get away with it. If it's medium funny, maybe don't do it.
There is a a great documentary about Don Rickles that I don't know where it's streaming now, but you should go watch it. Don Rickles, a comedian that is curiously, you know, cannot exist today. Yeah, the kind of jokes he was telling was of a time.
Insult comedian?
Like racial and ethnic insult comedian? Look, the 50s and 60s that he grew up in were very segregated by races. There was a different world in which he grew up in. That being said, in that documentary, Chris Rock is asked, why could he get away with it and nobody else now? And Chris Rock's statement, finally, I'll cite somebody that wasn't canceled. Chris Rock's statement was, being funny is like having big tits. You could just get away with more. And Don Rickles was really, really, really funny.
That's true. Yeah, Hasan Minhaj, I mean, you would think that his show Patriot Act would be right up my alley because I love The Daily Show and it was supposed to be similar to it and it just wasn't that funny. So that I could have a little bit of bias there where I just don't find the guy that funny. So yeah, I think the naming specific people is his worst sin.
I think that's the other thing is, I don't know, name your top five Hasan Minhaj bits. You know, I think we are all fans of this art form. And Hasan Minhaj has gotten a lot of opportunities. And there are more comedians for which I can name hilarious times that I laughed at than him. Oh, well.
Can I have a lightning round question for you three?
Go. Yeah.
Next Daily Show host. Who do you want?
I want Ronnie Chan. I think he should have been it from the beginning. I think that he's much funnier than Trevor Noah. Trevor Noah seems like a reasonably nice guy. I've never found him particularly funny. I find Ronnie Chan hilarious. I've seen him do stand-up live. He's incredibly funny. He should have been the host from the get-go. He should have it now.
Louis C.K. mine would draw more ratings. I'm just saying mine would draw more ratings.
How about you? What do you think, Jen?
Michelle Wolf. I would love to see her get it.
Michelle Wolf. Mm-hmm.
I don't even think she's in the running, but she'd be perfect.
I don't know. To be totally honest, I'm joking about Louis C.K. I don't think it should be somebody that came out of the tree. I honestly think that you know, the ship that sailed was John Oliver. If you wanted to pass the baton, he was the guy to do it. But if it's not from, just get a new tree. Like The Daily Show benefited greatly going from Craig Kilborn, who did a very Sports Center inspired, absurdist show. That's where he came from, to Jon Stewart, who did a very Jon Stewart kind of show. If you just do a copy of a copy of a copy of Jon Stewart, which is what anybody who comes out of that tree is going to do, and Trevor Noah did, then you're just going to get a paler and paler imitation of something that was at the time extraordinarily original. For The Daily Show, I would want go in a totally other direction. You know, apparently, like, Anthony Jeselnik was very, very close to getting Weekend Update. And that would have been a gigantic change. That would have been far more in the Norm Macdonald, you have to tune in because you have no idea what's going to come out of his mouth kind of host compared to Michael Che and the Colin Jost that they have now. I would say, and I don't know if you need to go in the mean direction in the way that Jeselnik would have for SNL compared to the very likable Amy Poehler and Jimmy Fallon. But I think go with somebody totally different. Totally, such totally, as? Totally different.
Find the funniest kid on TikTok. I mean, like, truth, because there are, like, much as I despise much of the new media landscape, there are some really, really funny young people on TikTok.
Shane Gillis. If you want a serious answer, I would say Shane Gillis. He is somebody that is very dialed in on the news. He would bring a different vibe to it, and then surround him with that writer's room. I think he's likable. He's already been canceled. You could bring an element of the fact that he was already canceled from SNL. He would be, all the other comedians would fucking despise him because he would have gotten an SNL nod and a Daily Show nod, which normally comedians would kill their own mother for one of those. So that would be great to see all the comedians jealous. But if you want a serious, totally out of left field answer, that would be mine.
That's a good one.
I think it's a good idea to go out of the tree. I think you're right. In part because I think that part of what made The Daily Show so funny and so magical in the early 2000s
was that it was so of its time in terms of making fun of cable television news at the kind of the peak of cable television news. And when it became hyperpartisan and the Bush years, it was really well situated for that. I don't feel like we're living in that time anymore. We're living in a much more internet-based time. And so having somebody that grew up in a different medium that understands it intuitively would make sense to me. Or a middle-aged bearded white guy from Oklahoma. One of those two things.
Was Michelle Wolf ever in the tree? Because I was first exposed to her when she murdered at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, but I don't remember her from The Daily Show.
No, that was all from Colbert on. I think Stewart might have done it, but that's been a parade of Daily Show correspondents for the Correspondents' Dinner. That's part of. Yeah, Hasan Minhaj and they all did that that thing. But yeah, I believe Michelle Wolf was a Daily Show person.
Yeah, I don't remember her, but I wasn't watching it that closely. But I still think she would murder it.
Turns out the show was kind of stinky. It's been a little gamey for a minute. You know, it hasn't had, and I don't know. Because also to go back to Gillis, I saw a clip from him where he was talking about people who are really, really into history, young people who are really, really into history, that is early onset Republicanism. Like, that's the kind of shit that it's like, I don't know. You could, there's a funny joke that involves an actual punchline as opposed to just saying Orange Man bad or Biden is Dementia Joe or the kind of reductive dumb shit. We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. I'm sure we'll get a lot of emails on this episode. We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. 20,000 leagues under the sea lies your takes. We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. Andrew Heaton sports question of the week. Aaron Rodgers, Jesus.
Aaron Rodgers, Jesus is a great man. It's actually Aaron Rodgers Jesus. He is of Latin American descent. I believe he's originally from Guatemala. His mother's from Iowa.
Yeah.
Aaron Rodgers Jesus. I'll tell you this. If you want somebody that believes in sportsmanship and can throw a goddamn ball, you call on Aaron Rodgers Jesus. If we'd had him as a fullback back in the 90s, we would have gone to the Rose Bowl unquestionably. Unquestionably, he should have got the Heisenberg Trophy.
You don't think that he's going to come back for the Jets?
You know, whatever his motivations are in sports, whether it's owning a private plane or just doing a good game, I think is to him. Wait, hold on. You all know this. I went to a soccer game recently. I went to a professional, and I enjoyed myself very much.
An MLS game.
I went to an which then so that's major or minor league?
Major.
Major league. I went to a major league sports game, and I had a lot of fun. Good time.
In fact, currently, MLS is, they've got the best player in the world in their league.
Roger Aaron's Jesus.
Let's go with that. A literal terrorist writes, I was listening to your discussion of NFL Red Zone and I couldn't help but laugh out loud in my truck every time Andrew interjected some random snarky comment to interrupt Justin or Jen.
Yeah.
All I could hear was my own voice trying to sound willfully ignorant to whatever sports related discussions I find myself falling into and injecting snarky comments. This especially happens during my two weekly game show events I host in local pubs and restaurants. Since the games are general knowledge to appeal to a larger audience, I always include sports questions and inevitably get corrected on some terrible mispronunciation of an athlete's name or something like that, leading to a non-athletic regular customers to cheer along with me. Go sports ball. You're a terrible person and I'd prefer you stop listening.
Oh, he must hate Tua Tagovailoa.
Oh, Jesus. Aaron Rodgers, Jesus. Go Big Ten writes, Go Big Ten!
Go Big Ten!
We got so many of these. So many of
these. Go Big Ten!
You got a catchphrase now. Turnover writes, Heaton, are you going to talk to your guest about Operation 2025, the Republican think tanks have banded together to create a program for the next Republican president to fire all of the quote unquote deep state permanent government workers to keep the government running from administration to administration. They want to fire 50,000 employees.
Great question. I think you're probably asking that in reference to my forthcoming guest, Michael Gleason, who wrote a book called, the name escapes me now. But basically, I think I alluded to this in a prior episode that I've got a guest coming on to talk about making the best argument I've heard in favor of the concept of the deep state. The interview has already been done. So no, I'm not going to ask him about that. Although I don't think he would have as much commentary on that in that I previously kind of thought when we were talking about the deep state that we were just referring to like, you know, deep bureaucrats, as you're alluding to in your email, of civil servants that are appointed but not elected, that are there for life, so on and so forth. My guest, Michael Gleason, makes a very compelling argument that and he wouldn't even call it the deep state because he doesn't really want to get caught in all of that. But basically that the national security apparatus constitutes effectively a fourth branch of government. And that is where his ire and surveillance are directed, at the NSA, CIA, FBI, and all of the different think tanks and contractors that kind of form that morass. So it would not be pertinent to our conversation, although it seems like an interesting one to have.
I, for one, think they're all great. Right?
Talking into my phone.
Rom Communist writes, my father was a union man and I grew up watching Star Trek DS9 episode Bar Association, where Rom forms a union will always come to mind when I think of unions. I was in high school before I met anyone who wasn't pro-union, and it blew my mind. It was my girlfriend, now wife's, working class parents. They seemed nice and are, but it felt like they had opinions only a cartoon villain could hold. I have more nuanced opinions now. Yet another example of why nerds are bullies. Bullying these poor working class parents for not having the right ideas. Defend them.
Far be it for me to speak ill of a fellow Deep Space Nine fan. Deep Space Nine is a phenomenal series. It is the Aaron Rodgers Jesus of the Star Trek franchise. Absolutely fantastic stuff. Yeah, you know what? So, something that Justin brought up in the last episode that stuck with me was that you know, there are good and bad companies, there are good and bad unions. That makes sense to me. I was in Scotland here recently, which is a labor stronghold. It's now SNP, which is just imagine the Labor Party only secessionist. So all the joy of Texas wanting to leave the union combined with Bernie Sanders. That's basically Scottish politics. And I would like, I'm just talking to my friends, like one of them had worked in a union and he really didn't like it. He started out very much gung-ho in favor of it. And he found that they were literally building faulty objects to create more work for themselves. I think all institutions are going to be subject to self-interest to some extent. And so you're going to find situations where they're doing self-interested things. And so anyway, yeah, go easy on your girlfriend's parents and watch In the Pale Moonlight, which is a fantastic episode of Deep Space Nine. Really good Garrick episode.
Starball!
Is that making fun of Star Trek?
It's make fun of you people. Ideas are dangerous, right? If my two-year-old gets any idea that she might be able to get candy or a cookie before dinner, then all hell breaks loose until she does. There's no reasoning or arguing with her. The only solution is to completely hide all evidence that there are treats in the house, out of sight, out of mind. I assume anyone who agrees with me will also agree that the American people are not to be trusted with dangerous information like the truth, as anyone who disagrees with me must have the intellect and judgment of a two-year-old.
I would love for you to tell us what you mean by the truth. Like, are you talking about like complex treaty negotiations where we got to keep it quiet till we actually vote on it? Or are you just talking about everything in general? Because if you're talking about everything in general, the problem that I have that we run into in any democratic society is if we don't trust the people to have information, why would we trust them to elect people to have the information? Like, how can you think that everybody's an idiot, but that when we all come together, we're able to make a good decision in terms of electing the people to govern us?
Well, I mean, to be fair, they are taking that ability away from us. Like, I think there are plenty of people in government right now that don't trust us to make those decisions and therefore jerry-rig the district maps and do all kinds of things to make it so that we don't actually choose. Like, you know, we don't get to choose who's president until they narrow it down to two. So, yeah, I think that's actually what's happening in our power structures right now. They don't trust us.
Elections aren't real. You heard it from Jen Branning. Big 10 clap Big 10. Emoji writes, Big 10 clap emoji. I'm not kidding. We got so many of these.
Big 10.
How to form a union in Washington writes, each state is different, but the short version is this. Define a class of employees, get at least 30% of them to sign a union membership card, file with the state labor board, have a vote of eligible employees to form a union. If it passes, create a bargaining committee of union members to negotiate a contract with your employer. Vote on the proposed contract. If that passes, then you have an active union. It's a shit ton of work that we volunteer to do during breaks and outside of work time because we legally have to. It's not easy to do. Currently, we are in step two, getting enough people to sign a membership card. The union he's forming is at a university. So I put that in there just so people understand, especially those who are very, very supportive of unions but are not a part of it. These are a lot of steps, and you do all those steps so you can then get the right to collectively bargain, which doesn't automatically make you a good negotiator. You could go through all that and then get to the table and then get worked by the other side, and everybody is beholden to the deal that you cut, which is not to say that unions are, again, good or bad. It is just that you better hope that you have talented people that are either a part of your local union or are part of the larger union, and they are looking out for your best interest, which in life is not always a guarantee.
So I'm aware that the answer to this might be, I don't know, which is perfectly fine. But I am curious if we know the legislative history behind these hurdles that have been put between the workers and forming a union. Like, is there a reason behind this, or is this like a 1980s Ronald Reagan era trying to make it impossible to form a union? Because it seems to me like, if an entire office decides to go to the boss and say, you have to pay us this or else we walk, like, is that illegal? Like, I don't understand the laws behind
this.
No,
you can do it. What this gives you are federal protections. So if you go, this is basically going to the DMV and getting registered as a driver, which now gives you protections to operate a vehicle that not having it does not, right? So if you just go and get all your people together and you say, hey, we're collectively bargaining right now with the boss, that is like what Amazon was asking for in what was looked at as union busting tactics. They are saying, no, you guys all get together, give us a proposal, and we'll negotiate with you to do it. What they don't want is the collection of all these unions with national organizations that have both the local chapters and the national chapters have federal protections of what guiding how the communication has to go, interjection of the National Labor Relations Board. That is basically to get access to the federal protections.
This is outside of my wheelhouse, but I think the legislation goes back and forth over the course of American history. You go to like prior to FDR, and it might even still be on the books in some jurisdictions, it was against the law to strike. You couldn't strike in certain jurisdictions. So it was very much against, like, again, the position I'm advocating for is the government is a referee in this. But for a while, the government was like very, very pro owner and put in legal restrictions and being able to form a union. That I think went very much the other way under FDR, where it became very easy to form a union to the point where you didn't even need a majority of the workers to do it, but you could still hold those workers accountable to it. It gets kind of weird on a state by state level where I haven't studied this in a while now, but right to work laws generally prohibit a company from exclusively hiring union people. So your company, like in some states, it might be where a company has to hire union people. And in a lot of right to work states, you are prohibited from only hiring union people, which I would say goes a step too far, because I, as a company, might want to have all union people. And if the company wants to do that, that would be fine. And we would work it out. So they go that. And then you get into like the whole thing changes when we get into public unions. So like, again, it varies state by state. But like some of the public teachers unions are public. We'll get it written into law that like all teachers have to pay into the public teachers union, that it's obligatory. It comes out of your paycheck. If you think that the union's crappy or you don't agree with their politics or whatever, doesn't matter. The state is going to force you to participate in it. So it ends up becoming a kind of football. And I think the solution is for the government to be a ref.
All right. Thanks, boys.
Like a soccer ball, like you saw the other day, a football.
Yeah, I was able to follow what was going on in the soccer game pretty well, and
it's a great live sport.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun. Here's my problem. I had a good time. I had a good time, and what I did that really helped was I really got into the cheering and the booing. So like people would boo, and I'd go, "Oh, boo!" And like I really get into it, like I was at a Lucha Libre match.
Yeah,
but I couldn't bring myself to care if the ball came with a goal or not. I couldn't quite get there, and then
I texted Justin. I think I did this
the group chat.
How do I gamble on this? Maybe that'll make me do it. And then I found out I can't gamble on it in Texas, the land of the free.
Well, yeah. I mean, you can gamble with the guy next to you in the other team's jersey. Just be like, $20, my team wins. And all of a sudden you give a shit when the ball goes in the goal. So there's ways to do it.
And then also,
wait, hold on.
I might make an enemy or a friend.
Are you so detached from other humans that you couldn't just be rooting for the home team to win so the people next to you would be happy?
I intentionally
fucking serial killer.
I kept drinking to try to like get into the mode. I'm getting so like Jesuitical during this game at the beginning because I'm like, all right, well, I want our team to win. Austin, because I live in Austin, but mostly because
Austin FC,
the majority of the people in the stands are from Austin. So in terms of psychic utility, more happiness will result for everyone here in the stands if Austin wins.
Yeah.
But if we were visiting and we were in Portland, who we were playing against, I'd probably root for Portland because then all those people would be happy. Right. But I'm like, well, that's not why people are here. I think it's just kind of a basic limbic us versus them thing. And that made me worry because I'm like, well, I clearly have a good limbic system. We all do. But I can't, I don't know. I think beer and just like enjoying the group doing
these
a thing,
are the people that say sports ball. This is what they think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you hear the fucking madness, the madness that goes on in their head? Like you can't just, everyone's excited. Just be excited. It's just that simple.
I can get excited that Verde, the group's excited.
Listos. It's a very simple thing.
No. The group euphoria I was able to get into. It's just the underlying. It's like going to church and enjoying the hymns and singing the hymns and having a good time singing the hymns, but not believing in God. That's kind of what it felt like to me. It was the underpinning thing I couldn't quite get into, but all the trappings I could
enjoy. The concept of one team I could be Unitarian about this.
I couldn't be Southern Baptist about this.
I think you're thinking about this too hard.
Yeah. You can't just be happy that everybody else believes in God and you're just enthusiastically making their experience better.
This is exactly why I kept drinking beer and it was a good call. I think you would have found my company was far. And I was having a good time the whole time, mind you.
But I was having
more fun towards the end.
I feel like you, in whatever Chat GPT model of how to be a successful sports fan, you just went right to hooligan. You were like, oh, I'm going to a soccer match. I should drink until I want to punch somebody in a Timbers jersey. Come here, you lout. I'm going to give you what for.
I enjoy the shouting. This is why I like a horse. I only go horse racing once every 3 years, but I like that because you're allowed to yell.
Well, you look like you own a horse. Yeah, that's the other thing. People would come up to you looking for tips.
Yeah. So I enjoy the revelry. And everybody was singing. I wish I knew the songs because I like singing. Group singing's fun. And there was this kind of like shuffle dance they would do. I enjoyed all that stuff.
MLS is really, really smart. They very much targeted their audience to millennials and Gen Z. It's a cheap ticket usually, unless the team gets really, really popular. And when they announce a expansion, like 2 years before they start playing, they start the fan club immediately. And so the fan club will come up with songs and chants and everything. And recruit people that just want to show up. If you're showing up at the fan club, then you get discounted tickets to stand in an entire side of that arena is just standing room only for the fan club.
That's where I was. I was in the fan club.
That's amazing.
And blended in real well. I own a black t-shirt and I wore that. And I have some green shorts. I wore that too. And when anybody would cheer, I'd be like, yeah. And then boo. And I learned who's the name of the coach is Wolf. And I'd be like, fucking Wolf. Fucking like, and then you can just always yell, kick the ball. So like, it looked like, I think I passed the Turing test. Like if you were there and you're like, is this man an android or a sports fan? Most people would have said clearly a sports fan.
When I get to Austin, would it help you if we went to the fan club and learned all the songs? Cause I would totally do that with you.
I'm sure there's a YouTube video.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, then we'll have a karaoke night where we learn all the songs.
They do. Did you do the McConaughey chant?
I don't know.
So they're in soccer, one of the chants that is common throughout the world is ole, 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 ole.
I knew the song, but it was Austin, different words.
It's all right, all right, all right, all right. All right, all right. Matthew McConaughey,
got it.
City icon. All right, all right,
okay,
all right.
You know what, guys? We're going to do this. Just like in Star Trek Generations, where Data finally gets an emotion chip that allows him to enter into the emotional state of his fellow crew. I will get there with you. We will have our Star Trek Generations data moment with me and football, soccer, all that stuff.
We're Not Wrong is a production of Dog and Pony Show Audio. Our editor is Will Saddleberg. Jen, the congressional dish. It's sizzling. What's cooking?
Well, I'm still going back through interesting hearings because Congress just came back from their 2-month summer vacation. And I did an episode on our organ transplant system, which is really fascinating how broken it is. I had absolutely no idea. And Congress actually passed a bill, which as of my first recording of it, it was sitting on President Biden's desk. I'm going to re-record it after this because I didn't like the way my microphone was working. And so, yeah, there'll be a second version coming. But when I recorded it, it was sitting on Biden's desk. I don't see any reason why it won't be signed into law. But it's one of these things that Congress can make a difference in our lives. And this was a beautiful example of the good that Congress can do. So if you want some uplifting congressional news before the government shuts down and we have 3 months of awful, this will be a good episode for you.
You know what? That's a fascinating topic. I'm going to listen to that. That is something that I periodically kind of dip into. And like, it's a sad state that like we're more backed up in terms of organ donations than Iran is, or I should say organ transplants than Iran is, because Iran you're allowed to sell. So like they, but in any event, we're very backed up. We've got all sorts of people that could really use help in the country. So I'm glad that there's been something proactive, and I look forward to learning about it.
Yeah.
Heat in the political orphanage.
It's been a big week for old Heaton. Two things this week. One, John Stossel came on the Political Orphanage. He'll be the guest this week. He comes on explicitly to give me advice on journalism. So it's me talking to a very storied and feted journalist about the nature of journalism and everything there. But the other big thing that's happening is that the TV pilot I've been working on comes out this Thursday.
Oh,
this Thursday night. I believe it airs on Twitter, I think is where we're going to do the debut. But for folks at home, it'll be safe Thursday evening or Friday morning. I want you to Google Adults Are Talking with Andrew Heaton. And if you Google that, you should be able to find it on Twitter or YouTube. You'll finally see what I look like. I'm very handsome. And there's some sketch comedy. There's some desk pieces. I make fun of Feingold and McConnell. And I do a really long interview. So a good long interview, mind you. So go check that out.
Feingold? That's an old reference.
Feinstein. Thank you. Sorry.
Okay.
Sorry. There's a lot of names bouncing around my head. I'm obsessed with Aaron Rodgers' Jesus. And so much of my middle bandwidth is like, will he make the cutoff?
ARJ. ARJ.
Good old ARJ.
The new patron saint.
Yeah. Yeah. On PX3, we're going to have Andrew Heaton on Friday.
Big week for Heaton. You hear this,
folks? He's been gone from America for so long, and he just ensconces himself in Scotland and peat moss and depression when he's out there, which is the local custom, of course. And so he doesn't follow news. So I answered all of his news questions, and that's going to come out Friday.
First question I had was, how's my favorite gorilla Harambe doing? And Justin was like, oh, I have very bad news about your favorite. I was like, keep in mind, it's my favorite gorilla in the world, Harambe. How's Harambe? And it was, you know what? I don't want to spoil it, but it was kind of a sad come to Jesus moment for old Heaton.
Come to Aaron Rodgers,
been gone
Jesus.
For 4 years.
Oh, for Jen Briney, for Andrew Heaton, I'm Justin Robert Young. I'm We're Not Wrong.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.